This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Hurricane Katrina demonstrated just how much pet owners love their cats and dogs when they refuse to leave their animals behind. Today, about a third of Americans live with a cat and or a dog and spend a mind-boggling $55 billion a year on their care. Most refer to themselves as their cat and dog's mom and dad, and most celebrate their pet's birthday. It's not unusual to hear about custody disputes involving a cat or a dog. Yet a little more than a century ago, these companion animals were seen as nuisances. What happened? That's what our guest David Grimm explores in his new book called Citizen Canine. In fact, he traces the evolution of the human relationship with cats and dogs over the last 10,000 years. He's a journalist and the online news editor of Science, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And David Grimm, thanks for joining us, and thanks for writing this book.
Thanks for having me.
And who is Jasper and Jezebel, part of the dedication?
Yes. the book is dedicated to my cats and my wife, the cats first, so I'm not sure my wife's so crazy about that. But yeah, Jasper and Jezebel are our two kitties. We adopted them about 9 years ago from a shelter.
So are you a cat person?
I am a cat person. I grew up, I worked in a vet clinic growing up. I thought I wanted to be a vet when I grew up. So I love dogs. I've always loved dogs as well, but I've always had cats, and we have cats now.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this history of cats, which is so fascinating, going back about, what, 10,000
years
to the Middle East.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, cats, you know, it really entered our society in a very interesting way. About 10, 12,000 years ago is first when we started taking up farming. And when we started taking up farming, we started growing crops and storing grains. That grain attracted mice and rats, and those mice and rats attracted wildcats, which came into our villages from the deserts. Those cats came into our villages, sort of knew a good thing when they saw it, and they realized that if they were a bit tamer, a bit friendlier, that humans wouldn't kill them. They might give them some table scraps. And so it's thought about maybe 9,000, 10,000 years ago, these wildcats began to domesticate themselves on the road to becoming the house cats we know today.
But it's so interesting when you look at the history of cats. In Egypt, they were revered, really worshipped. During the Middle Ages, they were seen as kind of a representative of Satan or the devil. They were slaughtered, maybe helped lead to the plague of the Middle Ages. And today, you know, I guess they're back revered again.
Yeah, I mean, cats have really been on this. Cats and dogs have really been on this roller coaster ride. You know, after they came into our society, they were very much seen as not pets, but kind of like working animals. Like, we'll protect you, we'll give you food, you protect our grains. Very similar situation with dogs. You help us hunt and herd, and maybe we won't kill you. We'll keep you around. And then in ancient Egypt, cats became gods. In ancient Rome, dogs were sort of seen like children. The Romans actually buried their dogs in the same cemeteries they buried people with. But then in the Middle Ages, well, it wasn't really a good time to be anybody in the Middle Ages.
No, but certainly not a cat or a
dog, right? Especially
wasn't
a good time to be a cat or a dog. It's thought that in the 13th century, a pope named Gregory the Ninth first linked cats to Satan. He was trying to stamp out heresy in Europe, and he said, you know, one way to spot a witch is it's always hanging out with a cat, and cats actually are an incarnation of Satan. This led to the slaughter of millions of cats across Europe, where they almost became extinct. Oh. And it's thought this actually may have led to the rise, helped foster the Black Plague, which killed maybe as many as half of Europe's population, because cats killed rats. And when the cats disappeared, these black rats, which were carriers of the plague, bred out of control. Dogs were also blamed for the plague, so they were killed in large numbers too. And it wasn't until recently that these animals really started to become pets again.
You had an interesting actually piece in Science having to do with, I guess it's the cat genome,
right?
Understanding how this wild cat became this more domesticated cat. Although having lived with cats, they're semi-domesticated.
That's right.
They're not entirely domesticated.
Well, there's this really interesting study came out last week where researchers are really trying to figure out what changed when cats became domesticated. And they isolated about 13 genes that changed from these wild cats to domestic cats. And they're really interesting genes. Some of them are involved in fear responses and food reward responses, which you would expect. You know, cats had to become less fearful of people. They had to have a reason to stick around, and maybe that reason was food. And also genes tied to learning and memory, which you would also expect with domestications. Cats have to learn to be more social, to get along with people. And even though some people consider cats semi-domesticated, I actually don't agree with that. But there does seem to be less changes in the cat genome than the dog genome, which we would expect. Dogs have lived with us for potentially up to 30,000 years, and cats only for about 10,000 years. So dogs have had a lot more what we call natural selection time on their genome than cats have, which is why some people consider cats semi-domesticated. But, you know, our cats sleep in our bed. They turn on our alarm clocks in the middle of the night. I think they're domesticated as any other animal, but opinions right. vary.
Well, the reason I say that is when you let cats outside, and I know bird people don't want you to do that, but when you let cats outside, you know, they do love to kill things.
That is true. I mean, that's one really big difference between cats and what we call other domesticates like dogs or even cows and other types of livestock. Cats really sort of do retain a bit of this wild edge. We actually do let our cats out for a little bit every day, and I actually try to keep an eye on them. But even so, you see a cat outside, and it's very different from the cat inside. It sort of reverts a little bit to its wild ways. Its senses really come online, and it becomes this hunter and this vicious carnivore, which you don't always see with that cat sleeping in your bed. And that's one really interesting thing about cats is they're sometimes able to sort of, and I talk about this in the book, really sort of straddle that line between domesticated and feral in some cases.
Well, and I often think as cats are, you know, 8 to 10 pounds, something like that. I mean, I've seen ones that are twice that. But generally, the sort of size of a baby, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And you can carry them like a baby.
Yeah. Well, I think that actually, you know, it's been a big question about why cats are believed to be the world's most popular pet. Actually, in the U.S., dogs are the most popular, but worldwide, cats are actually the most popular. And there's been a lot of question about why cats, why not some other animal? I think some of it gets back to the fact that they're cute. At least I think they're cute, especially kittens
are cute.
But also this idea that they're very a manageable size. You can carry them around like babies. You don't have to feed them gobs and gobs of food every day, you know. And especially in ancient Egypt, this was an animal, this was a society that was a very busy society, didn't really have time for pet keeping, and cats are animals. They know, they go to the bathroom by themselves, they hunt their own food, and so I think that's one of the reasons cats became very popular in ancient Egypt, not only because they were protecting these people, they were protecting their grains and actually killing snakes and scorpions and other things, but because they were a very easy pet to have around.
You mentioned go to the bathroom. I didn't know. 1947, the invention of kitty litter.
Right.
How much did that change the life of cats and the people who live with them?
Well, you know, it's been this really interesting question about, you know, why cats and dogs have become family members. And I think one of the biggest things driving that is their move indoors. For dogs, this really started happening in the late 1800s. And the reason that started happening for dogs is because we had the advent of flea and tick products, flea and tick shampoos. So you couldn't bring dogs inside before because they smelled and they had parasites. Once you could shampoo them, you could start to bring them inside. Well, with cats needed a toilet. And remarkably enough, kitty litter wasn't invented until 1947. So it really took cats decades longer than dogs to begin coming indoors. And we still see a little bit of that disparity today. There's still a few more percentages of outside cats versus outside dogs. By and large, both pets are largely indoor pets today.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's our guest, David Grimm. We're talking about cats and dogs in this hour of Radio Times. He's the author of a new book called Citizen Canine, and it's subtitled Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. And we are talking about that evolution, a bit about the history as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, tweet us a picture of your cat or dog or horse or chicken or pig or whatever animal you love and that lives with you. Let's talk a bit about dogs. And we've done numbers of shows about the relationship between human beings and dogs because it's so unique, it seems to me, and unusual and intense, this intense bond between people and dogs. How do you understand that?
Well, I mean, one of the really remarkable things about dogs is, you know, like I mentioned earlier, we domesticated dogs somewhere between 15 and 30,000 years ago. Dogs were the very first thing we ever domesticated. So they've lived longer with us than any other animal. And so I think we've just had gobs of time to develop this really close, intense relationship. Also with dogs versus cats, we've really bred dogs for very specific tasks, to hunt, to herd, to look certain ways. And so, you know, there's just been this intense social relationship. There's been this intense co-evolutionary relationship. And I think that's why we're so close to our dogs today. And there's been studies done that dogs sort of are tuned in to people in a way that really no other animal is. And we can see that with the ability to train dogs, with our sort of picking up things like we feel like, you know, there's jealousy in dogs and we can tell that our dogs love us and all this other stuff. I think a lot of this comes from just this intense relationship we've had with them for such a long period of time.
You interview Brian Hare in this book. He's been a guest on the show. He's a researcher, I believe, at Duke University. And he's in some some fascinating research about pointing.
Right.
That the significant when you point, a dog understands that.
And it seems like a simple task. You know, you have a couple cups, and maybe one cup has a treat under it, and these cups are turned upside down, so the dog doesn't know which cup has the treat in it. And you point at the cup with the treat, and the dog always goes to the cup you point at. And it seems like simple, and actually even one-year-old children can do this. But remarkably, chimpanzees, which genetically are closer to us than any other animal in the world, can't do this, but dogs can. And actually, another test actually showed that cats can actually do this too. And this gets back to this idea that these animals have been with us for so long, they've really sort of developed, you know, it's, you know, from an evolutionary point of view, it really makes sense for them to be tuned into us. They need to know what we're thinking. They need to know what our desires are, what our wants are. Otherwise, it's really hard for them to coexist with us, especially it's really hard for them to live in our houses, to sleep in our beds. If you don't know what your dog is thinking and they don't know what you're thinking, it's really hard to have this close intense relationship.
I began by describing Hurricane Katrina and the fact that people would not leave their largely cats and dogs behind. As you write in this book, that was really in many ways a turning point. First of all, rescue people realizing just what this relationship was all about. But then we got these laws that were put into place about animal protection.
Yeah, Hurricane Katrina was huge signifier in our changing relationship with cats and dogs. What happened is, you know, the floodwaters came, the rescue boats or the rescue helicopters would come to people's houses in New Orleans, and the rescuers would say, well, we're going to rescue you, but we can't take your cat or your dog. And a lot of people said, then I'm not leaving. They're a member of my family. I'm not going to leave them behind. And it's estimated almost half of the people that stayed behind in Katrina stayed behind because of their pets. And a lot of those people ended up dying. And so in the aftermath, this was a very divided Congress. I know that's hard to believe, but 2006,
shocking.
2005, very divided Congress. But they really united almost unanimously against behind what's called the Pets Act, which was an act that now federal law that impels rescue agencies to save pets as well as people in natural disasters. And actually, since Katrina, a lot of states, I think more than 30 states now, have their own versions of these laws. So now you're seeing pets being rescued in floods and wildfires and earthquakes, being admitted to things like Red Cross shelters, given transportation out of town, just like people are. And it really gets back to this idea that cats and dogs aren't just pets anymore. They really are starting to become part of our family and part of our society.
We're almost having a break here. You interviewed some of these rescue people in New Orleans.
Yeah, I spent a whole chapter on Hurricane Katrina because it's just remarkable. You had people really risking their lives to go into the floodwaters, to go into these flooded homes and save cats and dogs that were trapped inside. And it's just really remarkable. Again, showing this relationship. You know, you wouldn't do that. You're not going to go into somebody's home and save their toaster or save their couch. But people are risking their lives to save other people's cats and dogs, which really gets back to this idea that these animals are really becoming a part of our society.
Let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about cats and dogs with our guest David Grimm. He's a journalist. He's also the online news editor of Science, and that's the world's leading journal of science news and scientific research. And he did 4 years of research and writing for his new book. And again, it's called Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. And if you listen to Radio Times at all, you know we love cats and dogs and all sorts of animals. We want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us a picture of your cat or dog or animal at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with David Grimm about dogs and cats and the relationship between dogs and cats and the people who live with them and love them. His book is called Citizen Canine. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You write at the end of the book, the parallels between the rise of pets and the rise of children are uncanny. Spell that out for us.
Well, first of all, it's really interesting. You know, more than half of American homes have a cat or a dog. That's actually twice as many homes as have children, remarkably
interesting.
Enough.
Interesting.
So that's one interesting parallel. But yeah, you know, in the 1800s, actually, children legally were kind of viewed as property. Parents could sort of do whatever they wanted with them. That included abuse. That included companies really sort of exploiting them. It wasn't until the mid to late 1800s that you started to have these child welfare laws passed and really really recognizing that children were actually beings that deserve protection in the eyes of the law. And actually, that actually really parallels some interesting aspects of what happened with cats and dogs. In the 1800s, cats and dogs were actually not even considered property. They were considered so worthless, they weren't even considered property. But in the mid-1800s, you start to see the rise of organizations like the ASPCA, which actually had its own police force in New York City and actually helped protect cats and dogs. You start to see federal laws and local laws protecting all animals. But as these cats and dogs especially became members of our family, a lot more laws protecting cats and dogs. And actually today, as of a few months ago, all 50 states now have felony anti-cruelty laws in their books for abusing animals. But the penalties tend to be the harshest if you abuse a cat or a dog, sometimes as harsh as 10 years in prison and $125,000 in fines. So children have come a long way, and actually cats and dogs have come a long way as well in terms of how society protects them.
You talk about pets being part of the family. I remember years ago when one of our dog got injured and taking him to one of those emergency rooms that are now set up to take care of animals that have been, you know, hurt pretty badly. And what was so incredible to me was not just how wonderful the staff was, but all the people there with their cats and their dogs, and mostly cats and dogs, just maxing out their credit cards. I mean, you just knew this was like a $2,000 bill, and someone was going to max out their credit card to make sure that that cat or dog got fixed.
Yeah, and that was actually one of the inspirations for me for the book. Several years ago, after we adopted Jasper and Jezebel, they were just kittens. But a few months into having them, Jasper came down with massive kidney failure. We rushed him to our vet. Our vet said he's probably going to die, but you can take him to this emergency clinic. He spent 3 days in the emergency clinic. He saw a nephrologist. He saw an internist. I felt like we were at Johns Hopkins, you know, which is just down the street, you know. And he got hooked up to IVs and saw blood chemistry profiles and all this other stuff. And long story short, it ended up costing us about $3,000 for 3 days.
I believe
which,
it.
You know, at the time, we didn't really have that much money. We were just coming out of being students. But we were, even though we had only had this cat for a few months, we were happy to spend that because he had become like a child does. He'd become a member of the family. And sitting there in the waiting room, we realized that we weren't alone. You saw people crying, pulling out that second credit card, pulling out the checkbook. And that really started to get me thinking about just the place these animals have in society. First of all, that we're able to spend this much money because vet medicine has just exploded dramatically, but that we're willing to spend this much money, that people don't laugh at you anymore for spending hundreds or even thousands of dollars on your pet, just shows how close we've come with these animals and how much, from a society's point of view, it's accepted to really treat these animals like members of the family.
But do you think that we're living more and more with cats and dogs because there's a loneliness, perhaps a sort of a disconnection maybe with people or maybe even the outside world?
Well, that's the billion-dollar question, actually probably the $60 billion question. We're expected to spend $60 billion on our pets this year, which actually dwarfs the economies of about half the world's countries. But yeah, that's the really big question. Why, especially in the last couple of decades, have cats and dogs really morphed from pet or companion to true family members? And I think a lot of it is this increasing isolation. You know, we live in a much more virtual world than we lived in a couple decades ago. We friend people on Facebook instead of in real life. We tweet people instead of talking to them. And, you know, we all go out to a cafe with a group of friends and we spend the whole time staring at our iPhones instead of talking to each other. And so I think increasingly cats and dogs are really this last, as I write about in the book, they're sort of our last anchor to the real world. You know, the cat is not going to go into the other room and play on her iPhone and ignore you. The dog is going to
want... Not yet.
Yeah, not yet, right. You know, your dog's not going to go play Xbox in the other room when you want to play fetch with them. So these animals, increasingly, when we go home at night, they're sometimes the last sort of physical, living, loving, you know, contact that we have that's not virtual. And I think that's really helped transform them from pets into real members of the family.
I mean, but there is something so, it's like tactile isn't really the word, but just the touching, the petting
right.
of a cat or dog. There is something soothing about that.
There
isn't. There's no getting around. You can feel it.
You can feel it. And actually, there's been scientific studies that show that this is good for our stress levels, our cardiovascular health to have pets, that these animals, just having them in our lives actually makes us healthier people.
You also did a, sounds like almost like a ride along with some animal police or protection people out in Los Angeles.
Yeah, the LAPD, the LA Police Department, is actually one of the only police forces in the country that has an animal cruelty task force, which means it has a dedicated unit of detectives and regular police officers that actually go out into the street and they bust people for things like animal abuse, dog fighting, cock fighting, things like that. And so I actually spent, one of my chapters, I actually spent a few days riding along with them and seeing some of the things that they see. Some of it was fairly horrific stuff, but, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, when we have one of the largest police police forces in the country having a unit dedicated to prosecuting animal crimes, we really have said that these animals are worth protecting. They're worth devoting these resources to. And what these police officers will say is, you know, when we bust people for dog fighting or abusing a cat or whatever, a lot of these people tend to be people that are abusing their spouse, that are abusing their children. So we're taking bad guys off the street, regardless of why we're taking them off the street. When you bust people for abusing animals, often they're abusing people as well.
Well, and even this description, as you did this ride along, I mean, it seemed that there were also just these limitations going into a house, seeing, you know, this is not a good situation, but, you know, is it abuse? Is it neglect? Those very gray areas are very troubling.
Right. You know, like any other police officer, they have to, you know, these detectives have to, you know, make on the spot decisions. Do we arrest these people? Do we take this animal away? Do we call in, you know, the, you know, animal control and take this animal away? So, you know, just hanging out with them and seeing the kind of decisions they have to make. And they go into some very dangerous areas, very gang infested areas. And they're going to these houses where, you know, in neighborhoods where people are shooting each other up. And these detectives are sometimes actually putting their lives on the line to rescue these animals. So it was really sort of amazing to see some of this stuff.
I do want to get to some of our callers, and also we have a lot of social media people that want to join our conversation as well, but I do want to talk a bit about pit bulls, which of course were the sort of much maligned dog of maybe even today, but certainly there have been, you know, pit bull laws put into effect. I know some fantastic pit bulls that are dogs of friends of mine.
Yeah, I live in Baltimore, which has really been ground zero for a lot of this pit bull problem as far as people sort of in Maryland. The high court passed this judgment a few years ago that declared that pit bulls were inherently dangerous. You saw a lot of other states you're banning pit bulls or severely restricting their ownership. And I really went into this as a journalist. I want to go and, well, what's the truth here? And what I discovered, you know, like you're saying, Marty, is I met a lot of pit bulls, which are just amazing dogs. A lot of times in the vast majority of these cases where pit bulls bite somebody, these are dogs that are abused, that were used for dog fighting, that were severely mistreated. And so like any other dog, they tend to lash out. And it turns out historically, it hasn't always been pit bulls. You know, it was Dobermans and Rottweilers. A long time ago, it was Collies that were considered the demon dog. Imagine like Lassie being considered a demon dog. So it seems like every few decades, we pick a new dog to demonize for whatever reason. And now it seems to be pit bulls. But, you know, I met a number of remarkable pit bulls. Pit bulls that go into elementary schools in the inner city in Baltimore, and these kids that have reading problems or autism, the dog will come to the room, and all of a sudden these kids will open up. They'll start being able to read. They'll start being able to interact with their classmates. And so I think it was really important for me to see, you know, both sides of this animal.
In fact, you went into a prison and you saw a prison program with prisoners working with dogs.
Exactly. And that's increasingly popular around the country where prisoners will work with dogs, will walk dogs, and that sort of helps rehabilitate them. And actually when a lot of these prisoners leave, they can actually find jobs in animal shelters because they've had this experience working with dogs.
That is our guest, David Grimm. And again, we are talking about cats and dogs in this hour of Radio Times, the subject of his new book called Citizen Canine. And it's about the evolving relationship between human beings and cats and dogs. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet, send us a picture of your cat or dog at WHYY Radio Times. And again, David Grimm is a journalist and the online news editor for Science. Let me get, looks like Tim from Ardmore to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. This
You're welcome.
A really interesting conversation. I grew up with dogs my whole life. I grew up in a rural setting, so I had dogs around me all the time and just have had them my whole life, so I'm a huge dog lover. But I'm kind of curious about or have a sort of idea about the why there's this burgeoning amount of money spent on in vets and how much money we spend on our pets. And I'm not sure whether it's all just that we're just becoming more attached to our pets, but that our lifestyles actually keep us away from pets more and more. And I think that part of the guilt about not being able to be with our pets makes us more prone to want to spend more money on them, whether it's putting them in hotels or renting limousines for them or taking them to the vet whenever they, you know, get a little bit ill or something, that we're just very quick to bring them there out of a sense of guilt because we're not spending as much time with them as we might, like as far as I did, had my animals around me all the time because it was just part of life. I didn't, so it wasn't so much that we were in an urban setting and left for the day and left them crated and things like that. So I'm kind of curious what your guest would make of that, the sort of the guilt of owning animals and not being able to give them the time that they deserve.
A very loaded question, Tim. Thanks for the call, David. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I mean, I think certainly we feel guilty for things we didn't used to feel guilty for. When I grew up, we left our cats alone for days when we went on vacation, and we would just sort of leave out extra food and water. Now, if we leave for a few hours, we feel bad, you know? We hire pet sitters for the cats if we're gone even for a day. Obviously, people have hired dog walkers during the day while they're at work. Not only do the dogs can be walked, but they have companionship. Things like this, things like doggy daycare, like doggy bakeries, like kitty kindergarten, things that we would have laughed at as a society 20 years ago are now really becoming the norm. So I think there is this guilt. And the question is, where does the guilt come from? And I think the guilt comes from is when these animals really become less like pets and more like family members. Obviously, you would never leave your child alone all day by himself. So if you're considering your dog or cat like a child or like other family member, you're not going to leave them alone. And if you have to leave them alone, you want to make it up to them. You want to get them a really nice treat or take them swimming at the doggy playground. Or, you know, again, spring for that really expensive veterinary care because you say, you know, you're part of my family and you're worth it.
But I think for a lot of people, they are part of the family.
Yeah.
And that is what if you're a family member, you know, we're going to take care of you.
Yeah.
And we also know from a lot of vets and also research that, especially with dogs, you know, left alone, these are social creatures. Oh, they miss us.
For sure. Yeah. And, you know, dogs for sure. And, you know, people used to think, well, cats don't miss you. Cats are really antisocial. But I just, you know, on Saturday, just to set a real recent example, my wife and I drove up to Wilmington, Delaware for the day from Baltimore. We were gone the whole day. And we're like, well, it's just a day. The cats will be fine. Came back at night. And the cats were so clingy with us. They were like, please don't leave again. You know, it was just amazing. And of course, we tend to anthropomorphize a little bit. It's always hard to figure out what your pet is really thinking. But we felt so guilty about that. And maybe that was what the cats were trying to make us feel guilty. You never know. But, you know, it's a really good point that, you know, when we develop these incredible attachments, we start to really feel this guilt, you know, that we maybe didn't feel before.
But there are questions about going overboard.
Sure.
I'm looking at the toy section of a pet store, as you say, is staggering. Gone are the days of pale rubber dog bones. They're stuffed squirrels and dragons, soft rubber frisbees, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
I mean, if you've been there, it's sort of like Toys R Us.
Right. And it's not just the toys, it's the food. You know, organic pet food is, I think, one of the fastest growing segments of the pet market. We're talking about grain-free food, gluten-free food, you know, free-range chicken to feed the dogs or a raw diet for the cats. You know, and this is amazing because 100 years ago, there wasn't even pet food. You know, there was just table scraps. Right. And then you had companies like Ralston Purina who were making feed for livestock, got real smart when they realized pets were coming indoors and said, let's market pet food, because you're not going to feed a family member feed, you're going to feed them food. And so you started to have the earliest dog food and cat food, which was really morphed into this multi-billion dollar pet industry today.
We have an email from Karen. Does cats and dogs' ability to smell or sense diseases or disasters/emergencies have anything to do with their domestication?
I'm not sure it has anything to do with their domestication, but we're really learning some really remarkable things, especially about dogs, their sensing abilities. I write about some studies in the book where dogs have been shown to sniff out cancer actually more accurately than some lab tests, where we have dogs now that with people with epilepsy, they can somehow sense a seizure coming on and will tell their owner to get medication or will sort of comfort them through a seizure. And so, you know, dogs especially, just because a lot more research has been done on dogs and on cats, we're just really realizing they have these really remarkable abilities that they probably always have had. But now that they live in such close quarters with us, we really be able to harness a lot of them for the first time.
Do you see, and we're learning more about military dogs, and that's not new to the military, but there are now more studies and stories about dogs on the battle lines. There are service dogs, of course, therapy dogs, therapy cats. Do you see this as sort of, you know, not just that they're in our family, but now, using the title of your book, they're getting closer and closer to what we might call citizenship?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really interesting idea. You know, the book talks a lot about cats and dogs becoming family members, but I also want to spend a lot of time about not just these animals becoming family in our homes, but also becoming sort of fellow members of society. And what does that mean? And some of that means that we're spending billions of dollars on them, or we're rescuing them, and we've got all these laws passed to protect them. But it also means that, you know, we've got, I visited Lackland Air Force Base in Texas, which trains more military working dogs in any other place in the world. We have dogs fighting and dying for their country. Dogs are being shot in foreign wars. They're coming down with PTSD. They're being given medals, even like human soldiers. We're seeing therapy dogs, therapy cats. So these animals aren't just family members. They're actually performing these really important roles in society. And what other animal besides human beings is doing that? And so that's what I mean when I talk about citizenship. I don't mean cats and dogs getting the right to vote or drive cars, but really actually becoming a functional member of society just like the rest of us.
What you're saying is that if we start giving them jobs,
yeah,
which clearly if we're talking about the military or service,
yeah,
dogs or therapy dogs and cats, those are jobs.
Those are jobs. That's for sure. Yeah, they may not get paid, but it's their own reward. You know, the dogs especially really like to have jobs. The military working dogs are some of the happiest dogs I've seen, and these dogs that help their owners out, I think, are really satisfied by that. So they get something out of it, even if it's not a monetary reward.
I mean, this is a very human response, but you know, with rights come responsibilities. So you know, what kind of responsibility? And dogs have been put on trials.
Yeah. Well, this is really remarkable because I mentioned cats and dogs didn't used to be property, then they became property. And over the past few decades, we've seen this sort of fuzzing of the line in the legal system between property, which all animals are, all, at least all domesticated animals, and person, which we are, because we've seen cases where cats and dogs can now inherit money as of 2000, where owners of slain cats and dogs can sometimes recoup what are called emotional distress damages, which means sometimes damages in the tens of thousands of dollars if their pet is killed. And those damages are typically reserved for spouses or children. And then there's actually a few cases I write about in the book where dogs have actually been given lawyers. There was a case in Georgia where a dog was given a lawyer. The dog had bitten a child, and the lawyer was actually successfully able to argue for the dog's release and get the dog off death row, essentially. So this is really remarkable. These things wouldn't happen for toasters or couches. We have custody cases over cats and dogs. People are not fighting over custody of the toaster, and the judge is not saying which home would the toaster be happiest in, but judges are increasingly saying which home would the cat be happiest in, which home would the dog be happiest in. So as the status of these animals has evolved in our home, it's also evolving in the eyes of the law, which is really interesting.
Well, let's take a second break and then we'll get back to our conversation. I want to talk about research because I think your book raises some interesting, provocative questions about animals and research and the evolution between human beings, their relationship with cats and dogs. And again, David Grimm is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a journalist. He's the online news editor of Science. He's also the author of a new book called Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us a picture of your cat or dog at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. If you're just joining us, we are, yes, talking about cats and dogs. And our guest is David Grimm, author of a book called Citizen Canine. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. And I'm told we're getting lots of tweets, lots of pictures of cats and dogs on our Twitter page at WHYY Radio Times. Well, so let's talk a little bit about, cats and dogs have been used as part of research, medical research, other kinds of research as well. Where does that stand today? And of course, it raises questions about other animals that are also used for research, scientific research.
For sure. And actually, some of the first experiments that were done to sort of figure out how the human body works in the 16th, 17th century were done on cats and dogs. Dogs especially were a very popular research model. And in the early days of the U.S. is really burgeoning biomedical research. In the first half of the 20th century, cats and dogs were very popular in the lab. As these animals became a lot more like family members, the public got increasingly uncomfortable with that. Dogs and cats have largely disappeared from the research lab in the U.S. There's still a few thousand being used, but by and large, researchers have moved on to animals like mice and lab rats. But researchers are really sort of paranoid when they're concerned when they see this sort of evolving legal status of cats and dogs, because if cats and dogs become much more protected, they become much more like people, what's to stop that happening from lab rats to mice and lab rats? And farmers really worried, if cats and dogs get something like legal personhood today, what's to stop cows and chickens from getting something like that? And what's that going to do to meat production? And what's that going to do to cures for human diseases if it happens to mice and lab rats? So I really wanted to get into that towards the end of the book. This idea of giving rights to animals is not uncontroversial. There's a lot of proponents, but there's a lot of detractors as well.
Well, and I mean, I think it's important to raise all those questions for us to think it through. It's hard to imagine coming to some kind of consensus on that issue.
That's for sure. And, you know, what's really interesting is even owners, you know, could deal with a whole new world. You know, you can imagine if your cat or dog is more like a person, that makes you more like the guardian of a child. And what if you decide not to walk your dog three times a day or decide not to spring for that $3,000 kidney therapy for your cats? Could some sort of pet protective services show up at your house and take your pet away, like a child protective services might take your child away? And it may sound kind of ridiculous, but actually some critics have raised these points by saying, you know, there is a, we know we should really put limits on how much the status of these animals evolved. And I think that's going to be the really interesting point over the next few decades is just how far we really want to allow especially the legal status of these animals to evolve in our society.
Having had to put a number of animals to sleep myself, and it's always just, you know, this heart-wrenching thing to have to do. But I've also felt, and perhaps this is segueing back to humans, this is a very personal decision that people make. And now we're struggling about those end-of-life decisions when it comes to human beings and, right. and whether or not to help someone end their life.
Yeah, and euthanasia especially, not just because of this relationship we have with our pets, but just because there's so many options on the table now. It used to be if your cat or dog got really sick, you would go to the vet and the vet would say, I'm sorry, the only thing we can do is put this animal down. Now your vet says, well, we can put the animal down, or you can spring for this $5,000 kidney transplant, or we can try this experimental chemotherapy, or X, Y, and Z. And you, viewing this animal as a family member, how can you not spend that much money? And yeah. so a lot of people go into debt, spend a lot of money to save these animals because they can't stomach the thought of euthanizing them. So we were at this really tricky place with medical care for animals as well.
We have an email from Gary. He says, for most of my life, I've owned both dogs and cats. There is a joke that to me expresses the essence of how dogs and cats differ. When you call a dog, the dog will immediately come. But if you call a cat, the cat will take a message and get back to you with it.
Right. My favorite is dogs have owners, cats have staff. So
right,
along the same lines.
Also an email from Karen. Oh, no, we did Karen. Facebook from Joanna. Does your guest have any feedback or advice for someone who's looking to adopt a cat for the first time? Is it important to adopt them from a no-kill shelter or other shelters? As you said, you adopted some cats a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I'm a really big advocate of adopting animals from shelters. Even though these cats and dogs have become such an important part of our society, we're still euthanizing more than 3 million cats and dogs every year in the U.S. because we can't find homes for them. So I really, even though I objectively approach all this as a journalist, I'm not very non-objective when it comes to, you know, we should really try to adopt animals as much as we can. And I recommend for cats to get two cats. That, you know, people say that getting two cats is actually easier than having one. That's actually been our experience as well, because especially as kittens, they tend to play with each other. They tend to get each other's energy out a lot more. And I'm sure that goes for dogs as well. But I really think adoption is the way to go if you can.
Let me get, it looks like Will from Bucks County to join us on Radio Times. And Will, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I've been a vegetarian for a while. And a big reason for that is that I found it always ironic that we treat cats and dogs the way we do, and yet we eat pigs and cows and sheep. And I wonder, you know, if this move towards citizenizing,
yep,
could bring us towards a more peaceable kingdom amongst the rest of the animals that we share the planet with.
Will, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Do you see it that way? Talk about evolution.
Yeah,
right?
I think it's a fascinating question. I mean, as we become closer to our cats and dogs, we really start to see a lot of the animal world through the eyes of our cats and dogs. You know, increasingly, cats and dogs are really the only animals we have very regular contact with. We've seen these interesting polls over the last decade where now a majority, I think, of Americans under 30 oppose animal research. We've seen problems with people being more concerns about animals in captivity, whether that be zoo animals or whales and dolphins. And I think a lot of this, I talk about this towards the end of the book, I think a lot of this stems from our relationship with our cats and dogs. Increasingly, our children are growing up with these animals not as pets but as family members. And so then when they become adults, they start to see the emotions of all animals through the eyes of their cats and dogs. They said, you know, if I could have this close of a relationship with my cat or a dog, and I know my cat or dog felt love and felt all these other emotions, why can't this dolphin feel that emotion? emotions? Why doesn't this cow feel those emotions? And, you know, I'm not trying to come down one way or the other, but I think it does explain some of the shift in some of these polls where we seem to be adopting a more humane attitudes towards a lot of other animals as well.
And as you say, people that live with cats and dogs often refer to themselves as the mom or the dad.
The mom or
right?
the dad. A poll came out said 83% of owners talk about themselves
guilty.
As their cat's mom and dad. One of my 90% consider their cats and dogs members of the family. Here's my favorite poll from the book.
Okay.
If trapped on a desert island, more than half of all owners would rather live out their days with their cat or their dog than with a human companion. I don't know if that says more about our relationship with our pets or more about where we are as a society, but I love that stat because, you know, as funny as it is, it really does show, you know, how close we are with these animals.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Will, thanks for the call. Let me see what Barry from Westchester has to say. Hi, Barry. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Wanted to know if the compassion that you said has extended to cats and dogs recently, if you believe it will ever extend to coyotes and wolves, which apparently share 99% DNA with dogs, because there are two states, one Idaho and the other one Wisconsin, they're having these hunting contests, and for no other reason than to kill these animals, they don't eat them. If you think that compassion will ever extend to the point where it will be forbidden to actually hunt these animals, if we'll ever get the compassion that we have for cats and dogs for coyotes and wolves.
Yeah, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I really do think it you know, does. And getting back to my previous question and previous answer, I mean, I really think that as we develop this very close relationship with our companion animals, we can sometimes extend that to other animals as well. And I really do think that cats and dogs are really going to be the bridge between our compassion for our pets to our compassion for a lot of other animals.
We have an email from Allison. It's a long one. As you can see from my signature, I work at the veterinary hospital at the University of Pennsylvania. Haven't seen the book, so I don't know if this is discussed, but veterinary medicine keeps pace with human medicine, and what now can be done for pets is order of magnitude more sophisticated, complex, and effective than what was available in the last century. I mean, there's just no doubt about that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I have almost a whole chapter about this in the book, how veterinary medicine was essentially saved by the rise of cats and dogs because vets used to work on livestock. They sort of considered cats and dogs completely useless animals, just sort of like the law did. But as the livestock started to disappear from cities, as horses started to disappear from cities, vets increasingly turned to cats and dogs for their livelihood. And now, you know, companion animal medicine is a huge part of veterinary medicine. And, you know, just because, you know, it's been sort of this feedback loop. You know, we care more about our pets, so we want to provide the best care. Veterinarians provide better and better care. We pay more for this care, so veterinarians provide more and more care. You know, and I think, I mean, a lot of this is good because now we can save our animals and care for our animals in ways we could never before. But, you know, there are downsides as well, as you know, as I can speak to personally of spending
sure.
thousands of dollars and trying to save my cat.
Well, so did Vernice. Apparently, our dog just had a traumatic injury when hit by a car. Oh, I hate that. Not only have we maxed out our credit card for her care, we even sought crowdfunding. I mean, you know,
yeah.
you know, this is not surprising.
No, not
surprising
at all. Yeah.
I was talking with you during the break about what's been described. We actually did a show about it, this underground railroad,
yeah.
To borrow a term, where dogs, I think largely dogs, but probably some cats from the south where there are more, I think, kill shelters
yeah.
and just more strays. Being hauled from sort of one station wagon to another up the East Coast, and then they get adopted. And I know a number of people, family as well, that have adopted dogs and cats through this Underground Railroad.
Yeah, this is part of this no-kill movement where, you know, I mentioned we're still euthanizing 3 million cats and dogs in shelters in the U.S. every year. And one of the ways to try to curb that killing is to take animals from these overcrowded shelters. They tend to be shelters in the South, but not always, and take them to places like the Northeast, which have much less crowded shelters, and get these animals adopted out, because that's the number one reason these animals get killed in shelters mm-hmm. is because shelters are just overflowing. They can't care for these animals. Nobody's coming to adopt them, and so the only option is to put them to sleep. And so people are really trying to say, if we can get these animals out of there, get them to another shelter, to a no-kill shelter, we can adopt them. And, you know, the goal for this entire movement is to really get to, you know, as little euthanasia of cats and dogs in the country, at least when it comes to euthanasia because of overcrowded shelters.
Let me get Dan. Looks like Dan from Trenton joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm curious, when it comes to municipal animal shelters or other animal shelters in the Northeast in particular, I'm calling from New Jersey, and we just had a news item about a regional municipal shelter getting raided by the SPCA. What is the average euthanization as well as death by disease rate in the Northeast. Is there an average number that you're aware of? Is there, I don't know if it's the appropriate term, but is there an acceptable level of percentage-wise? I can take my question off the air.
Sure, Dan. I don't know if we're going to give you an answer or not.
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't have an answer for that one.
Okay, Dan, sorry, we can't answer that, but that's okay. It's an honest answer from our guests. Do you think, though, that there is a risk associated with more and more thinking of our cats and dogs as people?
Well, there's some of the legal risks that I talked about, and I think, it's sort of a question of whether that's a good thing or a bad thing to sort of treat our animals like people. One thing I do talk about towards the end of the book is that as much as how great it is to embrace these animals as family members, because we get so much out of them as much as they get out from us, there is this sort of issue with, if we treat pets so much like people, we sort of forget that deep down, they're still animals, and they still have animal needs. And that's why, I know it's not always popular to say, we take our cats outside. I try to supervise them so they don't get hit by cars, they don't kill animals. But, you take your cat outside, you take your dog outside, and this is an animal that sort of gets to experience the world as an animal. The cat gets to climb up a tree, and scurry through the bushes and really sort of remember what it's like to be a cat, which they don't always get to experience when they're indoors. Dogs love going for walks and just sort of smelling the world and sensing the world. And so as much as we've turned our animals into people, I think we should also sort of really value their animal side as well, because it's really remarkable. And especially us, we're so removed from our animal past that I think cats and dogs really sort of are our last lifeline to our animal past. And it's kind of cool to experience it every once in a while.
Did you grow up with animals?
Just cats. So
just cats.
Yeah.
You really are a cat person.
For sure.
I have seen, as I'm sure you have, people putting their animals in baby carriages.
Yes.
Or carrying them in little snugglies. sometimes you just wonder, what is too far?
Yeah, and
how
I
much
think
is
that,
too much.
That gets back to it. I mean, like, I'm not going to pass judgment on anybody that does that. When we first had our kittens, we tried to dress them in Christmas sweaters. There's some hilarious pictures of cats.
Oh, please post them on our Twitter page.
Trying to get out of their Christmas sweater.
Yes.
So we don't do that anymore. We were guilty of doing that early on. So I certainly can't pass judgment on anybody. But this does get back to the idea that I think there's a limit to how much we should turn these animals into people. We should really value. I mean, being a cat or being a dog is actually a really cool thing. There's a lot of things they can do that we can't do, and we should value that part of their personality as well.
We have an email from Leslie. I absolutely believe that dogs are becoming true citizens of our society. I have a therapy dog, and she and I have spent hours at places such as schools and libraries, universities, and even hospitals doing everything from comforting sick children to helping struggling readers to helping college students de-stress during finals week.
Yeah, I mean, and you see that, even in horrific tragedies like the Newtown massacre and things like that, where they'll bring in a gaggle of golden retrievers that will help people sort of just deal with grief. And it's just, we're just realizing there's so much we can do with these animals beyond just sort of having them sit on the couch and catch frisbees, that they can actually really play these really sort of fundamental important roles in our society, which I just think is amazing.
We're almost out of time here. Was there anything here that just surprised you? I cannot believe this.
So much. But I mean, getting back to the military working dogs, in the military, you expect to be a very sort of conservative aspect of American society, and it is. But when we talk about this idea of pets becoming more like people, this is even starting to happen in the military. The military currently considers its working dogs equipment, which means it considers them no different from a gun or a pair of boots. But we've started to see, even in the military starting to allow the awarding of unofficial medals to start to provide lifelong medical care for its dogs like it does for its human soldiers. There was even a move in Congress a couple years ago to have these dogs reclassified from equipment to canine members of the armed services. That didn't actually go through, but the very fact that was brought up just shows that even in the military, we're seeing this just dramatic social evolution of these animals.
Well, David Graham, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for writing the book as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And the book is called Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. And he's the online news editor of Science. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out how to download a podcast of the show. Check us out on Twitter. Check out all those pictures that we posted. Also Facebook, and also information about satellite radio. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Quinn Libson, our intern this fall. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us.